The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Nothing like this has ever happened before. There's never been anything like it.
Donald Trump was right about that. There's never been another trial like it. The first criminal trial of a former president of the United States. It's being referred to as the Hush Money case. The Manhattan DA says it was a coordinated effort by the former president to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to spike salacious tabloid stories about his alleged affairs with women before the 2016 election. But the hush money really isn't the issue. That's not illegal. The DA says that Trump repeatedly falsified business records by disguising the payments as legal expenses, amounting to campaign finance violations. Jury selection is one of the most important, if not the most important, part of a trial. And that process of selecting 12 jurors and 6 alternates began this afternoon, with the morning taken up by the judge hearing hours of motions. Joining me is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin. Michael, what does the jury questionnaire tell us about the jury selection process or the concerns of the judge here?
The jury questionnaire is a comprehensive effort on the part of the judge to ensure as maximum amount as possible that he picks a jury that is not walking into this courtroom with a predisposition that will override the evidence and the jury instructions that are given to them at the end of the case. So I think that he's doing the best he can to try to carve out from the jury pool those people whose predisposition will overarchingly impact their way they view the evidence.
Do you think that the defense will be looking for working class people, maybe not college educated, with negative views of law enforcement?
What I understand from reporting on the jury experts that have been advising Trump that they're targeting young African-American males and working class whites. And I think it's to that exact theory, I think it's rather cynical, honestly, that those classes of people will somehow be more suspicious of the police and therefore more inclined to be sympathetic to Trump's argument that he is being persecuted and is the victim of overarching police activity and not really the subject of a righteous prosecution.
And experts have said that prosecutors will search for people with college degrees and white-collar jobs, and they're likely to prioritize getting women on the jury?
That's what they say, because this is an affair and a hush money attempt to cover up that affair. There'll be testimony from another alleged victim of Trump's bad behavior, and so their thought is that women will be more sympathetic to the prosecutor's view that here is a predatory person who is now endeavoring to cover up his predatory behavior in order to cynically win the presidential election. So, yeah, that's their theory. Every lawyer, prosecutor or defense alike, has their view of who is the juror that's most going to be receptive to their message. And if the prosecutor believes that women will be more receptive, then they'll use their peremptory challenges, that challenges which let them remove people for virtually any reason, as long as it's not, you know, race or class or religion sort of stuff. And the defense will do just the opposite and put on the people that they think will best be sympathetic to their message. It's not really an effort to find the archetypal, independent-minded, with no predisposition juror. It's who can I get on my jury that will most likely be sympathetic to my argument? Because remember, in a criminal case, the verdict needs to be unanimous. And so if you can pull one juror who says, I have a doubt in either direction, convict or acquit, then the jury gets a hung jury, and then they got to start all over again. If they start all over again, that's a clear victory for Trump, because second trial, a retrial, were that necessary, would likely not occur before the election.
Do you think the judge is looking for, you know, middle-of-the-road juror, not biased in either way? Or, I mean, what is the judge looking for?
Exactly right. The judge is looking for this middle-of-the-road, we'll listen to the evidence, we'll listen to the jury instructions, and we'll render a verdict based on the evidence and those jury instructions. Then you see the effort the court is going through to accomplish that, which is they're asking, what newspapers do you read? What television stations do you watch? What's your view of the world of QAnon and Kifa and all that stuff to try to cull out, if you will, the people who are playing from the 20-yard line to the goal line on each side of the field and keep those who are willing to play in the middle of the field.
There is always a possibility of getting a stealth juror on a case. That's a juror who has an agenda but pretends to be neutral. In this case, it seems like there might be a higher incidence of that. How do you keep stealth jurors off the jury?
You can't if they're going to lie during voir dire, during the jury selection process. They're going to just flat out lie, saying, oh no, I don't believe in the big lie, or whichever way it falls out. If they're going to lie about that, it's very difficult to sort them out. The best you can do is say, all right, well, fine. You say that you don't believe in this, but let me ask you, where do you get your news? What stations do you listen to? Now, if they're going to continue the lie and say, oh, I listen to everything, I get all news sources, when they're a pure MSNBC listener or a pure, you know, Fox, OAN, Newsmax sort of listener, it's very hard to cull them out. You know, they're under oath to be truthful. And so theoretically, if they lie, and the judge will tell them if they lie, they'll be subject to prosecution for that lying, but you can't really ensure that that won't happen.
So then what are the chances that the judge can get a fair, unbiased jury in Manhattan?
Well, it's hard to know. The questionnaire, 42 questions with multiple sub-questions. So it's a very comprehensive jury questionnaire. And it's an experienced jurist. He knows what the wheat from the chaff is because he's done this before. It's not like Eileen Cannon in Mar-a-Lago, who's just become a judge. And so I think he's just going to rely on his instincts, and he can strike jurors for cause if he wants to. And he says to himself, you know what? I have a funny feeling about this juror. He can say, you know, ma'am, I'm going to excuse you, or sir, I'm going to excuse you.
A lot of the day was taken up with motions. Trump's defense had filed so many motions, and the judge handled them today. How big a win is it for the defense that the judge, again, refused to allow that Hollywood Access tape to be played for the jurors? He said that comments Trump made on the tape could be introduced as evidence, but not the playing of the tape itself.
I think that's cautious on his part. I think he wants to make sure that the evidence that comes in is probative, but not more prejudicial than probative. So, for example, he will allow evidence that says Donald Trump had allegedly an affair with Karen McDougal during a certain time period. They cannot say, by the way, during that time period, Melania Trump was pregnant. He says that aspect of it is just too prejudicial. You'll get what you need by saying he's done this before. Similarly, with the Access Hollywood tape, he's saying, look, I'll let you talk about the fact that he said these things, but to listen to these words out of his mouth is more prejudicial than probative. It doesn't prevent you from putting on your argument that this is a repeat offender, if you will. And so I'm going to err on the side of caution, because remember, what he wants to do is ensure that there is nothing on appeal that interrupts the verdict in the case, that it's not reversed on appeal because he favored one side, the prosecution, over the defense. He's looking for down the middle, probative and not prejudicial over the probative value of it.
It seems like in a lot of the rulings he makes, it's sort of like he's trying to be Solomon and, you know, cutting the baby in half. He gives some to the prosecution and some to the defense. Do you think he's acutely aware of the problem of reversal if he does anything that disadvantages the defense?
Absolutely has to be concerned, knowing who Trump is and how litigious he is, that if Trump is convicted, he is going to appeal. You know, death and taxes sort of stuff is going to happen. And so he needs to do everything he can to protect the record against a verdict reversal. And what he's trying to do, you know, is Solomon-esque, which is to make sure that everybody gets something without it being more, as I say, prejudicial than probative toward the final conclusion in the case.
So another one of the things that came up today was that the prosecutors were arguing that Trump's social media posts violate the gag order. Apparently, there was one from Wednesday where he references two sleazebags, which in context are Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. And the judge said he's going to hear this, you know, the attorney's arguments on both sides on Wednesday. I mean, is it too soon to actually fine Trump for disobeying the gag order?
I think it's plenty of time for them to determine that Trump has violated this gag order. I think he has routinely violated it, and he's been treated very fairly, more fairly than the ordinary defendant. And he's under, you know, strict rules not to talk about witnesses. It's very clear, as you say, who he's talking about. Without naming them, it's irrelevant because everyone knows who he's talking about. And I think the judge is going to have to do something to clamp down on it because the trial is not televised. So we don't get to see what's going on. So reporters come out and tell us what's going on. And then Trump comes out, or his lawyers come out, or both of them come out and give us their spin. And so you can fully expect that he's going to continue this rant against the people who are, quote unquote, persecuting him. And I think the judge has to make sure that that doesn't happen. I think he needs to make sure that Trump doesn't get away with poisoning the jury pool.
So about half of the 100 prospective jurors were dismissed because they said they couldn't be fair and impartial. So the trial day ended with zero jurors selected, and the judge saying they were already behind. Do you think he can get it done in 2 weeks?
It's going to be a tight deadline. I hope he can. I think 2 weeks should be enough time. You know, he said that the court will meet on Mondays and Tuesdays and Thursdays and Fridays. You've got Passover coming up on Mondays and Tuesdays, so he's going to let the court out half days. Some of the Trump lawyers, I think, have said they've got high school graduations that they want to attend. And he's got to be mindful of that. People, you know, obviously celebrating religious holidays is of critical importance. And not missing your children's milestone events is critically important. So he's going to have to figure that out, because it doesn't really make a difference whether the jury selection process takes an extra week. It's not going to, you know, make or break anything. And so I think he really should allow the parties to live lives around, you know, these important events. And the case will be as the case will be. It's going to go to trial. You know, if the evidence starts coming in on May 1st instead of April 25th, what's the big deal?
Trump has said he's going to testify. Most legal experts look at that and say he shouldn't testify.
Well, yes, he said he's going to testify, but he always says he's going to testify, and then he never shows up. He was going to testify before the January 6th committee. He was going to testify in Letitia James' case. He was going to testify everywhere he goes, except church, because he doesn't go to church. But he has said that, and I don't expect he will go there. I don't expect he will testify, but if the case is going badly for him, if the defense attorneys look at the way the evidence is coming in and whether or not their cross-examination of these key witnesses was effective, they may say to Trump, look, this is not going well for us. It's Hail Mary time, and you got to take the stand in order to salvage this. You can hypothesize a scenario where, while most lawyers would say to Trump, there's no way you're testifying, you'd make a horrible witness, that you could at the 11th hour have to make a decision that it's conviction or Hail Mary with Trump testifying. And remember, the thing here is because you need a unanimous verdict, all 12 jurors, a Trump testifier could be that which gets them the one juror to hang it. You know, he may convince that Trump-leaning but still on the jury juror that, you know what, Trump is in fact being persecuted, or in fact these are not business records, or in fact Michael Cohen is an incredible witness, or in fact Stormy Daniels has a axe to grind. So that's where it could play in. But I think if you and I were his counsel and he said to us before trial, so guys, thinking about testifying, what do you think? And say, oh my God, are you kidding? No, I've seen your deposition. You know, you can't go from A to B without wandering. So we'll see.
Yes, we'll see that, and I think a lot more during the next 6 weeks or so. Thanks so much, Michael. That's former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
There were rallies across Arizona yesterday to protest the state Supreme Court's ruling in favor of a near-total ban on abortion dating back to the Civil War. Protesters were rallying support for a ballot initiative to reverse that ban and allow voters to decide the issue in November. Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to the state after the decision to emphasize the stakes of the 2024 election for reproductive freedom.
Are you ready to make your voices heard? Do we trust women? Do we believe in reproductive freedom? Do we believe in the promise of America? And are we ready to fight for it? And when we fight, we win.
As many as 13 states have abortion measures on the ballot, including Florida, where a six-week ban is set to become law on May 1st. Abortion rights have won in all six states where it's been on the ballot, including conservative states like Ohio, Kansas, and Kentucky. Joining me is reproductive rights expert Mary Ziegler, a professor at UC Davis Law School. Mary, is the Arizona abortion law the most draconian in the country?
It's up there. I think we have Arizona and Idaho both having laws that only have exceptions for life, whereas most anti-abortion laws have some sort of very narrow health exception. So it's, I would say, you know, tied for the most stringent law in the U.S.
In this decision, the judges on the Arizona Supreme Court said their job was to interpret two potentially conflicting state laws, not to make a policy judgment about abortion.
Yeah, so Planned Parenthood's initial strategy, it's worth emphasizing, right, that in theory there could be more litigation in Arizona about abortion. This round was about the relatively narrow question about how the state's statutes could be reconciled. And Arizona has even more, you know, abortion statutes than the ones before the court. But this case, Planned Parenthood was pointing to the state's 15-week ban, which obviously was passed a lot more recently than this 1864 law, and saying essentially that that was the policy that the state legislature had intended to put in place, right? It hadn't wanted a ban for fertilization. It wanted to have a ban at 15 weeks. And secondarily, the legislature had confused physicians, essentially, that physicians were unable to tell if they were supposed to follow one law or the other, and that that created due process problems. And the Arizona Supreme Court rejected those arguments, saying essentially, when you're trying to harmonize these two laws, it's fine to let the 1864 law go into effect. The 15-week ban wasn't supposed to stop that from occurring, and that there was nothing in the clash between the two laws that would be too confusing for physicians.
So was it a determination between the two laws, or did they actually say, you know, abortion, these kinds of laws comport with a state constitution, or did they do the reasoning out loud?
They didn't have to get into that yet, because that wasn't the question before the court. So we've seen lots of other litigation in other states led by the Center for Reproductive Rights that, you know, is much more clearly about what the state constitution has to say. And that question, I think, is still unanswered to some degree in Arizona. But the upshot of Arizona's ruling is that this ban is now going to be in effect anyway. So, you know, constitutional question or no constitutional question, is the upshot is still going to be that Arizona has one of the harshest, you know, laws in the nation.
The court said it would put its decision on hold for 14 days so a lower court can consider additional constitutional challenges. What might those be?
Well, we've seen variations of different kinds of constitutional argument cropping up in the states. Some of these are based on constitutional equality guarantees in the states. Some of them are based on privacy or kind of liberty ideas. Some of them are based on a right to life for the woman or patient. Some, again, are based on vagueness, especially when you have exceptions that send contradictory messages about what is or isn't permitted. And we don't know, you know, which of those things, if any, will be compelling to the Arizona Supreme Court. Obviously, you know, the time frame for resolution of some of those claims is going to be pretty tight because the law is slotted to go into effect soon. But again, this is going to be an ongoing struggle in the state. We also have the ballot initiative that may be before voters in November, as well as retention elections of some of the justices who joined the majority.
So the Arizona Attorney General, Kristen Mays, said that despite the court decision, she would not enforce the 1864 law. But is it about her enforcing it, or is it about doctors not doing abortions because of this law?
Well, there are two problems. One, I think, is the question of whether the state attorney general can take the power to prosecute away from local prosecutors who may disagree with her on abortion. A second question is, to your point, whether physicians are going to be willing to perform abortions, because at a minimum, they would do so in a climate of legal uncertainty, right? I mean, the state attorney general, you know, has an office that's subject to election. There are other prosecutors who may try to press charges, and that creates uncertainty. And we've seen to date that physicians have been reluctant to try to intervene when there's doubt about whether they can do so without legal risk to themselves. And it seems that that could certainly happen in Arizona as well.
Yeah, I've been reading that in most states, even states that have exceptions to protect the mother's life, that doctors are reluctant to test those exceptions, except in cases that are so clear-cut.
That's right. And the reason for that, again, especially with life exceptions, is that physicians have been unclear about how close to death patients need to be before a life exception can be invoked. And I think they're especially concerned because, you know, they're being second-guessed by prosecutors who are very, in some instances, opposed to abortion and suspicious of the motives of physicians invoking exceptions. And also, it's worth emphasizing, some prosecutors who believe that abortion is never medically necessary, right? So in light of all of that, I think we've seen a lot of reluctance on the part of physicians, and there's no reason to expect Arizona will be any different.
Okay, Mary, stay with me. Coming up next, I'll continue this conversation with Professor Mary Ziegler of UC Davis Law School. Will abortion basically be on the ballot in the presidential election? I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Arizona was already expected to be one of the most closely contested states in November's presidential election, but a ruling last week by the state Supreme Court instituting a near-total abortion ban, a law dating back to the Civil War when women didn't have the right to vote and Arizona wasn't even a state. It seems to have added fuel to Democrats' push to add a question to the November ballot asking voters to approve a constitutional amendment protecting the right to abortion until viability when a fetus could survive outside the womb. Joining me is reproductive rights expert Mary Ziegler, a professor at UC Davis Law School. Ballot Initiative campaign organizers say they have about 120,000 more signatures than needed to get the issues before the voters in November. But the other side is allowed to scrutinize and challenge the validity of those signatures. Does that make it very hard to get an initiative on the ballot?
I mean, not to my knowledge. I mean, I think that we've seen, obviously, one of the kind of themes, you know, in recent years with ballot initiatives has been efforts to get these things off the ballot by making it hard, essentially efforts to make it harder for voters to weigh in altogether. To my knowledge, that the signature scrutiny requirement isn't particularly more effective in Arizona than some of the other strategies we've seen in other states. So I have no reason in particular to think that the ballot initiative will fail in Arizona for that reason.
Can you talk about the language in these ballot initiatives and how important that is? You know, I'm wondering if in Florida it's almost too expansive and that the opponents would be able to, you know, attack it that way.
Yeah, I mean, in Florida has a viability limit, as some other states have. It's not dissimilar from measures we've seen passed in Michigan and Ohio. And the strategies we've seen so far to attack the Florida measure are also parallel to ones we've seen in the past. Essentially, we've seen people saying that, you know, this is going to actually introduce, make legal abortions people don't want legal, or introduce protections for gender-affirming care or other things that would be sort of unintended consequences of this kind of strategy. That hasn't worked to date. And we haven't really seen, I guess I would say there's nothing really new in what the Florida opponents are doing as of yet. So I think really in Florida, it's going to come down to the fact that there's a 60% threshold as opposed to a more than 50% threshold, because we haven't yet seen a ballot initiative pass with more than like 55, 58, 59% of the vote. So Florida has polling suggesting that Floridians are more supportive of abortion rights than their counterparts in places like Ohio or Michigan, but that's going to actually be necessary to overcome the threshold in that state.
Former President Trump, who in the past has taken credit for appointing the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe, he made this statement about abortions, you know, everyone agrees abortion should be left to the states. Also, some ridiculous things about how everyone wanted to, on the right and the left, wanted to overturn Roe. Was there anything he said that was true?
Obviously, not all scholars agreed Roe should be overturned. Most people in the academy didn't want Roe to be overturned, which isn't a tremendous surprise because most Americans didn't want Roe to be overturned, and there's no reason to expect, you know, legal scholars to be extreme outliers in that respect. The other thing I think about Trump's statement was that it was unenlightening. We know that you have former President Trump's campaign officials and proxies who, even after his statement, essentially said, we think that former President Trump, if he's reelected, is going to, you know, treat the Comstock Act as a ban on abortion. And they said that even after he issued this statement. And when various reporters contacted the former president to ask about the Comstock Act, he essentially didn't answer the question. So we don't know what his saying he supports states' rights mean when he has, you know, proxies saying he's going to use this law as an abortion ban and he's not disavowing that. So I think there were parts of his statement that were false and other parts of his statement that were just confusing. So I have no idea what he thinks, and I'm no less in the dark than I was before he issued the statement.
There's been a lot of talk about this 19th century law, the Comstock Act, and how it could be used to prevent abortion. So tell us a little about the act and how it affects or could affect abortion.
So the Comstock Act is a 19th century obscenity law that contemporary anti-abortion groups interpret as an abortion ban because it contains some language making it a crime to mail or receive items intended, designed, or adapted for abortion. It's not clear that that's what it means, but that's what some anti-abortion groups have argued. And notably, people who have worked with former President Trump and his administration, who've represented him in court, who are very close to him, have been very vocal in the pages of the Washington Post, the New York Times, and elsewhere in saying that if Trump is reelected, he's going to use the Comstock Act as a ban on all abortions. Now, what's interesting is that Trump himself hasn't said he will do this. He also hasn't said he won't do this, even though he's been asked directly by NPR and other news outlets, and he just hasn't answered the question or disavowed this argument. And so the upshot is that, you know, it's possible he wouldn't do what his proxies are saying he will do with the Comstock Act. It's also possible that he will. And until we get a direct answer from his campaign, we're just not going to know.
How would the federal government enforce the Comstock Act? I mean, would they be going through the mail?
So historically, the Comstock Act, you know, you couldn't just open people's mail. You needed a warrant. So some of it depended on the same kind of chilling effect we've described with physicians, where physicians were essentially people were refraining from mailing items for fear of federal prosecution. Other than that, we know that there were scenarios where people would essentially entrap people. They would order pills or they would order items in the mail. And then when they received those items, they would then, arrest the person for violating the Comstock Act. We know that there was a lot of selective prosecution under the Comstock Act, so essentially targeting of political opponents as opposed to, you know, just your random person getting an item in the mail. We know that former Trump officials who are interested in this campaign have said that their plan is to prioritize the prosecution of those who manufacture pills or are professional abortion providers. But we have both historical examples and the kind of plans that have been laid out that give us some insight into what's likely to happen.
So even if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the FDA in the mifepristone case, the Comstock Act could still be used to get abortion pills off the market?
Absolutely, because it's very unlikely that the court is going to definitively rule out that interpretation of the Comstock Act. It's much more likely that the court will essentially leave that argument for another day. I think we're likely to see Clarence Thomas or Samuel Alito reference that argument without the rest of the court weighing in on it one way or another. So I think that argument is going to be a live argument in the future. And I think it's most likely that if the court does rule in favor of mifepristone in this case, it's likely going to do it in the context of saying, you know, essentially that the plaintiffs don't have standing, which wouldn't definitively rule out the Comstock Act in the future.
Right. Are these state Supreme Courts, with these radical decisions, are they moving abortion more even than it was before to the front of the presidential election?
I think so. They're also doing it in an interesting way by putting themselves on the ballot. You know, you have to remember that in both Arizona and Florida, some of these justices are subject to retention election. And historically, incumbents win retention election most of the time, but they're powerful counterexamples when you have a high salience issue like abortion that voters are aware of, then sometimes justices are kicked out, right? So the justices will be on the ballot. Ballot initiatives will be on the ballot. The stakes of those ballot initiatives are going to be very high because in both states like Arizona and Florida, there will be people living in very different worlds, right? People who will be experiencing these bans firsthand for the first time. And that will, I think, have consequences for the election. Whether it's enough, you know, for example, to push Joe Biden over the line in these states, I don't know. But it's hard to imagine that it won't move the needle.
Well, I think there's little doubt that abortion is going to be one of the top or top two issues this presidential election. Thanks so much, Mary. That's Professor Mary Ziegler of UC Davis Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcast. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to tune into the Bloomberg Law Show every weeknight at 10 p.m. Wall Street time. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.